Hey, welcome to the Toronto Today podcast. My name is Greg Brady, host of Toronto Today, which you can hear on the radio 5:30 to 9. But we put this podcast together for you to capture the day's highlights. Today, April 23rd, a lot of talk still about the police chief of Toronto, Myron Demkew, and his comments after the Umar Zamir not guilty verdict on Sunday. It was a trial of Zamir and a first-degree murder charge in the death of Detective Constable Jeffrey Northrup that has captivated the public's attention quite a bit. And Demkew's comments certainly didn't turn those temperatures down. We'll talk about it on Think Tank with Chloe Brown, Steve Paikin, and Marie Akins. We also get into the issues of international students and where this is going with so many students claiming asylum. It's not really what they ended up coming here for. We want this to work for all concerned, the institutions, the communities, and of course, the international students. So Earl Blaney, immigration consultant and education agent, will check in there. And Scott Reed weighs in on the story I mentioned earlier, the Toronto Police Services, and the implication of wanting the verdict to go a different way, which came in the statement from Myron Demkew. It came from the mouth of Myron Demkew on Sunday, and he hasn't exactly walked it back in 48 subsequent hours and counting. All that to come on the Toronto Today podcast, but we kick it off with Think Tank.
640 Toronto presents Think Tank, the breaking stories you care about, facts and opinions that get you through the day. Now, let's meet the guests.
Let's do just that on a Tuesday morning. Welcome in our three people on the panel. Anne-Marie Akins is Media and Crisis Communications Advisor. Good morning, Anne-Marie.
Good morning.
Chloe Brown, policy analyst, former mayoral candidate. We love our chats on Tuesday with Chloe. Good morning.
Morning.
And here's Steve Paikin, the host of The Agenda at 8 o'clock and 11 o'clock. Sometimes I find the 11 o'clock version is more spicy than the 8 o'clock version.
You know, despite great inflation, I still think you're worth 100%.
Is that like on TV those old days? Can you leave all the swear words in after 11? I feel like I don't know whether the Broadcast Standards Act factors in there. I have no idea.
Yeah, pretty sure it doesn't work that way.
I don't think it does either. I think it's it's spicy but clean. Let's put it that way. It's spicy and easy to digest. Robin Urbeck in the Globe and Mail, and everybody will have an opinion, and the world's full of hot takes, but this isn't one that I think is that. She, in essence, called for the Toronto Police Chief's resignation in Myron Demkew for the events over the weekend and especially the comments he made about the trial, in that he was disappointed with the verdict. I want you to hear the clip, and then I want to talk about that possibility and whether or not we could see this transpiring. Here's what he said on Sunday.
While we respect the judicial process and appreciate the work of everyone involved in this very difficult case, I share the feelings of our members who were hoping for a different outcome. Now, we will come together as a policing family during this difficult time. Every Toronto police officer should go home to their family at the end of each day after serving and protecting.
Now, I'm sure, Chloe Brown, I want to start with you. I'm sure there were calls for Mark Saunders' resignation in light of some issues around the Bruce MacArthur investigation and prosecution. But I don't think this is I don't think this is that. But I understand where Robin's coming from here. She says that statement should be disqualifying for someone with his job. And it's too ambiguous for me, in that you wanted a different outcome when the trial started or after all the evidence came in and a jury of his peers found him not guilty, you still wanted a different outcome. And we're on our third day. Chloe, I feel like that needs clarification, and the chief's nowhere to be found to give it.
I agree. The second half of his statement is what I would call an indoor thought, because ultimately the 12 jurors did their job, and even if you wanted a different outcome, that is something you should have kept privately to yourself. As a public official, the chief has a responsibility not only to his officers, but also to the public, and I think this is a really great time for them to review their plainclothes protocol, because Mr. Zamir was proven to be in fear for his life, and unfortunately, because of the way management operates at that level, someone lost their life. And there's absolutely a need for the public to get clarity from the chief, because right now we're in a very prickly situation.
That's risky stuff, isn't it, Anne-Marie? I even referenced yesterday, then President Joe Biden did something I didn't think he should have done post the murder of George Floyd, and that he weighed in on the Derek Chauvin trial, the officer that had his knee
on Floyd's neck. And he said the day before the verdict, I'm praying that the verdict is the right verdict. I just feel if you're in politics, and I feel like if you're the police chief as well, you've got to leave justice alone, either in the process of that trial and certainly in the aftermath as well.
I completely agree. I think that we've gotten into the habit of accepting a certain degree of interference from our public officials in the justice system, because many people find it frustrating. It's pretty opaque, and it's often we don't know the reasons for things. Things are kept confidential, and so for we don't understand. But I think what they need to do is respect our justice system, especially the independence of it, whether it's appointing judges, talking about that, or whether it's the decisions made by our judiciary are really important to keep those independent. Whether or not he should resign over those comments, hard to say. But, you know, the community looks at our chief police as a leader in things. And if he doubts the justice system, it's just going to encourage the public to doubt it as well. And this cloud is going to keep hanging over this man for the remainder of his life.
Steve Demke made it a priority during his swearing-in ceremony. He said that there were three massive priorities he wanted to focus on. But number one, above them all, was improving trust in and within the Toronto Police Service. And you lived here a long time, seen a bunch of different chiefs, and you've seen that trust sort of, you know, things do happen in waves. I think it's an important time right now for the police and this leader of the police to be more transparent. Being a cop's a tough job. The job is to serve and protect, and there's a lot of good men and women that do it, but they have to be trusted by the public, and they have to also trust in the processes around them.
100% right, and honorable people will disagree on whether the chief ought to resign over these comments. Robin Urbeck is a very good columnist, and she's laid out the argument that she believes would result in the chief resigning. But here's the reality. There are some jobs in society where you don't have free speech rights. You can't say whatever you want, whenever you want, because you have a position of responsibility, and therefore there are some limitations on what you can say if you want to have those jobs. I've got one of those jobs. Mm-hmm. I can't say whatever I want, whenever I want, because I may have to conduct a discussion on television about it, and I have to be seen as an honest broker, and therefore can't be popping off with all sorts of opinions. The chief has one of those jobs as well, and he crossed the line in this case, and whether he should pay for it with his job, you know, we'll leave that up to others. But I think that's a principle that stands.
Yeah, I think we lay that out there, Chloe, and we say it's one thing, and we played the clips of Jeffrey Northup's widow Sunday, and I give her a lot of space to say what she feels, and I think it's okay if she says this brings it all back. I'm overcome with emotion. I'm frustrated by the verdict. I wanted accountability. But the rules for the police chief of the city of Toronto are way different than a grieving widow. I think we'd agree.
Absolutely. And this is where the public has really just reached a tipping point with the way that management particularly operates, because I honestly believe that the public doesn't have a contentious relationship with officers. It's the management of them. Mm-hmm. It's CPA, and it's the variety of talking heads that really put their ego above the need of the public to feel secure, to feel that they can trust the law enforcement officers. So I would really love to see the police chief really get to the heart of the issue when it comes to this statement, because ultimately he has positioned the police to look like its own little gang that operates separately from the public service.
Chloe, drill down a little bit on that. Would you say, like when a case goes to SIU, sometimes we roll our eyes and say, is there going to be true accountability here? Is there really going to be peers investigating peers? But like you said, when somebody comes out for in a police car and they come to the scene of a crime or they come to help a family, there's an element of trust there. It's the process and sort of you're saying almost the administration of those rank and file officers. That's the problem.
Absolutely. And this is goes into the second topic of the OPP reviewing the Toronto police conduct. If there needs to be a public inquiry into the the plainclothes protocol that police use, it should be done openly. We as the public are the recipients of that action when plainclothes police make themselves embedded in our communities. And ultimately, it would keep us both safe if there was a better protocol, because ultimately, it's the police officers on the ground. It's not management. And we need to make sure that not only are civilians safe, but officers as well. So, yeah, it becomes one of those issues where management needs to open up its books and its protocols so that not only police officers see, but criminologists, social workers, anyone who's involved in law enforcement. And it's not just officers.
And Anne-Marie, this is a constant battle, I think, is that you'll hear all the time from good police officers, and they don't want to work with the bad ones. In fact, they want the bad ones out of the system. And I think we'd say that in any workplace. Teachers say it. Doctors and nurses say it. So why wouldn't a difficult job like police officer, why would you want to be paired with a partner you couldn't trust or someone you thought was unethical? This is going to be a fascinating scenario, as Chloe laid out, to see where this OPP review goes.
Yeah, it will be. And I think as much as officers say they don't want to work with the bad ones, they are very, it is very, very tight community because of the nature of the work that they do. And they have, I think, a very difficult time believing that that anyone is a bad officer, and or they make excuses for bad decisions in the moment and excuse them as a the officer itself is good. But I think one of the things, you know, to touch on what Steve said, that people like the police chief, the premier, the mayor, there are people that should not be questioning the decisions of the justice system. They can express in the moment, sometimes they do in the moment, feeling frustrated, and they say those words out loud, as Chloe said, those your indoor voice, but they should know better to apologize when that happens. So the chief would have been much better, and I think there wouldn't be calls for his resignation if he apologized that he spoke from emotion. That was a tragedy that happened that night, and he took it very personally, as all the officers did. And he could apologize. Former Mayor John Tory admitted that his words at when he was granted bail were inappropriate, and he said he's learned lessons. He would like more transparency from the justice system, but he at least apologized for it, and you got to give him props for that.
Steve, I want to get some of you about plainclothes police and ask you a question, but as Anne-Marie brings up, we've yet to hear from Doug Ford on the issue. I'm sure he'll be at an announcement that's unrelated, and I'm sure someone will ask him the question. Knowing Ford as you know him from news conferences, what do you think he says about it?
Well, I don't want to speculate on this because that'll only get me into trouble. And this is one of those.
That's what I'm trying to do here. You can tell.
Yeah. Well, no, you're quite right. The premier will have a press conference about something else. Somebody will ask him a question about this. And then he will probably, because he is very supportive of the police and has been for all of his time in public life, he'll probably say something. Oh, gosh, Greg, you're getting me in trouble here. He may say something that he shouldn't say. Let's remember, either we have faith in the jury trial system. Either there's only a dozen people who heard every second of this trial. The rest of us did not.
Yeah.
And they are the people who are, they heard all the evidence. They came to their conclusion. They did their jobs. You may not like the verdict, but again, we go back to the main point. That doesn't give you the right to pop off, particularly if you're in a position of trust in society with a job, with responsibilities. You just can't say whatever you want.
And plainclothes police, Steve, it's a sensitive subject, and it always has been. I was reading last night an NPR article about New York City and how they've just kind of gone in waves, depending on who the mayor is and depending how law and order the mayor is. If he's very law and order, there's more plainclothes police. If he's not, if he's more a David Dinkins than a Rudy Giuliani, there's fewer. But I get there's a lot of residents that complain for years that people not dressed in police uniforms are able to act a different way. When I watch that video, Steve, and follow that trial every day, I see a woman in jean shorts. I see a guy in a flowered shirt. No way, no how do I assume they're approaching me and I think they're police officers. But I get that sometimes you can't be in the uniform. It's a sensitive subject.
It is. You're absolutely right. But let's remember that the people who sat in that jury box are the ones that heard all the arguments, and they emerged from having heard all the arguments that there was reasonable doubt as to whether or not the family at the center of this understood that those plainclothes officers were legit or they had reason to fear that they weren't legit. That's what the jury decided, and I'm not sure any of us can second-guess them because we didn't sit through every second of this trial. They did.
All right. Think Tank with Anne-Marie Akins, Chloe Brown, Steve Paikin. We're rolling it up to top of the hour here. I sent you three a story about Ontario colleges getting international study student study permits. And there's this college and that college. We could play a game where I make up a college name and you're like, is that a real college or is it not? Yorkville University. I've never quite heard of that. But there's two campuses in Greater Toronto with 5,154 applications. And most of them are international students. But I want to get to a comment from NDP leader Marit Stiles on this. And Chloe, I'll start with you. I love talking the post-secondary world with you. She says fewer foreign students combined with insufficient funding from the provincial government, maybe that's an argument that's legit, will lead to cutbacks. Her question, how are they going to continue to meet the needs of the community as well as the province to produce the workers that they need to produce? But my goodness, I know you got to oppose things that Doug Ford and the Conservative Party do and have done and will do. But I think you got to go to Kitchener in London in some of these communities where 100 people are lining up outside a restaurant for two jobs or 50 people outside a movie theater for one job. And rent has skyrocketed in places like Kitchener and Guelph, Chloe. I don't get backing the amount of international students that we had last year and saying, well, that was a good thing. Everybody did a great job here.
Absolutely. I was just at Union Station and I saw the I can't even describe it, but there were so many international students with e-bikes trying to get onto the train.
Yeah.
And this is where, honestly, the NDP really frustrates me because they should be advocating for better transit in small and medium-sized towns. Immigration to small and medium-sized towns has been an issue for decades because there's not enough infrastructure. These members of provincial parliament do an injustice to the north by not ensuring that there's infrastructure there so that they get the population they need to survive. So honestly, I need Merit to figure out a better strategy because we really need to talk about the north falling apart as a home for people. If we really want to make sure that these towns survive, it's about building transit. It's about building housing. It's about building ERs, because even in Minden right now, the ERs are closed. How do we expect people to make these towns thrive if they can't even get essential service?
And Anne-Marie, this is about giving internet. This is pro-international student, these policies. Having fewer of them means better opportunities for the ones that are legitimate, that want to come here to go to school for work and might want a part-time job. So and again, there's great difference between what the provincial government and Jill Dunlop, the colleges and universities minister, plus at the time, Sean Fraser, the immigration minister, now Mark Miller, have done as well. But I don't get the comment. The concept of bringing international students here is not to provide cheap labor for companies. It's not.
No, I think there's lots of reasons for it. And I think Canada really does depend on our international students for a number of facets that we just can't get the workers for a variety of different fields, not low-paying ones necessarily either, IT, AI, web, transit building. There are people that we need to bring here in order to be able to fulfill all those jobs, but also the other jobs, the service-related industry jobs, because as much as people line up for jobs, we also hear that restaurants can't hire fast enough. They just aren't employees. And movie theaters, all of those service-related jobs, they just can't get the people enough people to participate in them. And I think many industries are still facing that. So I think the reason behind the restriction was really about housing and not being able to house everyone that lives here already. So that's what the restriction was about. So,
and Steve, your show is so Ontario focused. So you've heard the stories, you've heard the complaints from people in Kitchener, people in Guelph. Conestoga College had 30,000 international students at about $22,000 a pop. That's about $610 million. But not one of those dollars goes back into providing housing or shelter for any of those students. So this has all felt a little seedy. We're trying to correct it while not just closing the door, period.
Well, you've highlighted another example of how we seem to have a good chunk of our post-secondary system that is built on a house of cards. We have a system that is underfunded. Everybody says it. The province's own Blue Ribbon panel said it. And as a result, we have become overly dependent on foreign students in order to keep the system afloat. Then the federal government decides it wants to cut back on the number of foreign students coming, and everybody, surprise, surprise, is shocked that the rest of the system is falling apart. If you don't want to get to the foundation of the problem, if you just want to tinker away at the edges, I'm afraid nothing's going to happen. But it doesn't appear that anybody actually wants to deal with the foundation of the problem, and thus we are where we are. Does anybody, Greg, really expect us to get any better if we don't intend to improve the fiscal position of our post-secondary sector? I don't see how it could.
No, I suppose not. And then it gets back to, I guess I can end, I'll throw something that we didn't plan on, but just to raise tuition. Chloe, the average cost of an Ontario college tuition is still really affordable. It's just over $4,200. University lands at about $8,500, $9,000. And of course, affordable, like affordable housing is a really relative term. But a tuition hike right now might be really rough on a lot of families. But to Steve's point, there isn't the money coming from anywhere else. They rely on governments and tax dollars to fund these institutions.
Absolutely. And this is where the colleges and universities in these small towns need to ask themselves, like, what is our regional economic development plan? Because ultimately, these small and medium-sized towns can't even keep the kids born there. In those towns, they come to Toronto for the jobs. So this is really where, like, you need Grey County, Bruce, all of the counties above the GTA to figure out, like, what are we going to do together to make sure that we survive? Because ultimately, the international students here, they still have an opportunity to become employed. I would go as far to say that we don't even have a labor shortage. We have a shortage of good employers, because ultimately, these are jobs that Canadians could be working, but the wages aren't. They're subpar. The benefits are subpar. And right now, it's like I see so many people leaving to Toronto to go to these small towns. They could be working with the expats. Are we called expats?
Yeah, I think so now.
They could be working with Torontonians and Canadians and the international students to be starting new industry in these towns that have an opportunity to change the industries that they were once involved in. So I'd love to see a whole of community approach to revitalizing.
Anne-Marie, last word to you. We've had this tuition freeze in place for a long time for the province. We're going into the sixth academic year with tuition frozen. It's been something that the Ford government's bragged about, but it sure has, as Chloe and Steve documented, it's had some unintended consequences. That's for certain.
Well, I think I'm not even sure I would call it unintended, because freezing the tuition is like saying to landlords, and they would never do this, that your rent is absolutely frozen. You cannot raise it. I don't care what's happening. You cannot raise it whatsoever. It's like telling other businesses they can't raise their prices. So you have to, but schools, they feel that they can interfere. So, but we all know the costs for everything have gone up. So they've gone up for the colleges and universities. So they're paralyzed to be able to raise the income that they need.
Out of time. Thanks so much. Great discussion. Appreciate all you guys coming on.
Have a good one.
There's Chloe Brown, Steve Paikin, Anne-Marie Aikens joining us on Think Tank. All right. I want to come back and talk about the things Myron Demkew said about the Sunday comments. He did say that he spoke from a place of emotion on Sunday. Struggling with the death of a fellow officer. Got it. Understand it. Makes perfect sense.
And Scott Reed weighs in on the Toronto Police Services and the implication of wanting the verdict to go a different way.
There will be time to talk about what the next steps are. But I don't think the police and the administration of justice should be waiting for us. I think they can do some soul searching. Whether or not we do anything, they need to do some soul searching about some of the decisions that were made in the course of this investigation and this prosecution.
That's Nader Hassan. I think he's right about that. And time will tell whether Umar Zamir will pursue any other legal action. But there certainly is a bit of a pathway towards it. There's sort of some foundations that are set, and I think they've been set since Sunday. And you might say, who can blame him? We'll see if indeed that ends up being true. We're talking obviously about a twist that we didn't expect yesterday morning at 9 o'clock. We didn't know if police would take this seriously. And Myron Demkew, though his words conflicted many, snapped the finger and quickly called for the OPP to review the Toronto police conduct. Now, about the judges' concerns about the potential for getting their stories straight together. The part where they're all in the same room together writing out their statements. And I get that you would never, I'm not affixing the comparison to three guys get arrested for robbing a bank. You'd never let them sit together too long or too often or at all and let them get their story straight. But there obviously is a little bit of suspicion here, or a credible judge, a credible justice like the one that just handled this case would never say that, to say they're all wrong. They're all wrong in exactly the same fashion, which makes her wonder whether or not they colluded to tell the same stories. And if they did that, got on the stand, swore to tell the truth and nothing but the truth, then they committed perjury. We have to be careful. This is alleged perjury at that. But there's a lot of things that don't pass the smell test for an awful lot of people. Scott Reed's a lawyer and partner at Edward H. Royal and Partners. And I found his tweets fascinating and educational, and he weighed in on the process as well. Good morning, Scott. Thanks for joining Toronto Today.
Yes. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And you laid this out, and you found probably the same thing many people did, that the Myron Demkew comments right away, if we're to believe in justice, if we're to believe that we put our fate or the fate of another man or woman in the hands of 12 of our peers, there was a very ambiguous comment from not just a random citizen or even from the grieving widow, but from the leader of the biggest police force in the country. And as you put, translation, the entire TPS had hoped an innocent man would be wrongfully convicted based upon perjured evidence of several of our officers. That is how it landed for you and many others.
It is. It is. Could it have been more clear? Sure. But geez, the impression that was certainly left was that the officer, in hindsight, or the chief, having heard the verdict, wishes the jury had gone the other way, and that's just grossly inappropriate.
Yeah, there's a way, isn't it? If you're struggling with your emotion, there's a way to compartmentalize and say, this is how I feel, this is the agony I'm in now, but we respect the system, we move on, and the verdict is the verdict. That wasn't what came out of the chief's mouth on Sunday, and that's not even in his revised statement yesterday how it lands.
No, not at all.
What does that do to trust in not just the process, because we're talking about trust in law enforcement, but Scott, we also can take the leap over the hurdle and say we not only have to trust the cops, that's a given, we have to trust the justice system as well, that it isn't influenced.
Oh, that's right. And you can't, when you're in a when you're in a position of power, authority, like the chief, you can't call the jury system into doubt. They're the bulwark against wrongful convictions, and that's what this would have been. And I think that's what Justice Malloy was saying when she apologized to Mr. Zamir. You don't hear apologies from a judge to a defendant very often. The only time I've ever heard of a judge apologizing to a defendant is the Court of Appeal when they're overturning a wrongful conviction. For instance, all of Charles Smith's convictions
right.
that get overturned. They often will apologize to the defendant for what they've been through. You don't see it in trial courts. So, I interpret that as Justice Malloy saying, this would have been a wrongful conviction. That's as close as I've seen to a judge saying, this gentleman is factually innocent. Not a reasonable doubt. He is factually innocent.
How closely did you follow the case throughout the 5 weeks? We all have to fit different stuff in, but I'm sure you paid significant attention to it.
I followed it in the media,
yeah.
as close as I could, but I wasn't in the courtroom.
The undercover aspect is an interesting one, and as you know, the OPP has been asked by Myron Demkew to evaluate how Toronto handles plainclothes cop situations, undercover cop situations. That's a really tricky part of this process. There may not be much of a defense, and this is a pure hypothetical. There may not be much of a defense if they're all wearing proper police uniforms. Then there isn't much argument for, well, I wasn't sure if they were cops or not. But you look at the photos of the officers, including, rest his soul, the poor deceased constable, and none of them would come across as cops, would they?
No, none. And, that was one of my other comments, you see people like this, dressed like this, approaching your vehicle, depending on what evidence you accepted. Maybe they're pounding on the windows, the car, try and get them to open up. They're yelling at them. You assume that they're officers? I sure wouldn't. And, you know, is it the position of the police that simply saying I'm a police officer mandates that you believe them? Because it seems to me that gives carte blanche to, you know, carjackers to simply say, hey, I'm a police officer, open up your door. We don't expect citizens to do that, right? They have to have some reason to believe that the officers are officers, hence the uniform, the badge, things like that. You know, it's a undercover plainclothes police work is difficult, it's dangerous, but some of the procedures and their protocols, I think, make it more dangerous than it needs to be.
What about the publication ban? I thought about this a fair bit in that he was charged. This incident happened on July 2nd. He's charged pretty quickly with first-degree murder. Doesn't get out on bail in September. And as was documented by his lawyer, Scott, he missed the birth of his second child because his wife was in her third trimester when this horrible incident/accident happened. But I often wonder if a publication ban does more harm than good, because it got, hey, it's they have to own their words. It got a lot of politicians out there saying, this is ridiculous, this is terrible. And that might be, upon reflection, the emotion that they have. But they're in positions of responsibility. Again, they're not some rando on social media. These are important people. Mayor of the city at the time, John Tory. Premier of the province, Doug Ford, still the premier. What was your observation of that? And would a publication ban, the lack of a publication ban, at least give more context as to why he was given bail in the first place?
Well, it would. It could have. I think in hindsight, you know, it's easy to second guess. But you know, in the moment, you want to preserve trial integrity. You don't want people who might be trying the case down the road to have any advance information that hasn't been tested. And so you know. I understand why the publication ban at the bail was put into place. I think it was probably the right call at the time. But like you say, you know, educated persons in authority, like the premier, mayor of Toronto, mayor of Brampton, ought to know better than to make comments like that. I mean, John Tory's a lawyer. Doug Ford certainly has advisors who probably could have told him, you know, don't make a comment on this. None of that seems to have happened. Why, I don't know. But, you know, they ought to know better whether there's a publication ban in place or not. They ought to know, look, a test has been made, a judicial officer has heard evidence and decided that this person has justified his release. There's minimal, if any, safety to the public.
Scott, really appreciate your insight on this. Thanks very much for coming on the show.
Anytime.
Scott Reed joining us, partner at Edward H. Royal and Partners. All right, on the way back, asylum claims from international students have gone up. Why do they do it? Who's doing it? And how do we get it back to a better level? All honest, fair questions. We'll ask somebody who knows all on that front next on Toronto Today.
We seem to have a good chunk of our post-secondary system that is built on a house of cards. We have a system that is underfunded. Everybody says it. The province's own Blue Ribbon panel said it. And as a result, we have become overly dependent on foreign students in order to keep the system afloat. Then the federal government decides it wants to cut back on the number of foreign students coming, and everybody, surprise, surprise, is shocked that the rest of the system is falling apart. If you don't want to get to the foundation of the problem, if you just want to tinker away at the edges, I'm afraid nothing's going to happen. But it doesn't appear that anybody actually wants to deal with the foundation of the problem, and thus we are where we are.
That was TVO Steve Paikin, 640 contributor on Think Tank. There's a lot of lessons to be learned here about immigration and how that mixes with education at that. You are often seeing stories. I watch a ton of BBC and Sky News. I watch a lot of the UK stuff. And I didn't know this until a few days ago. And I know Donald Trump came in with a policy when he ran for president in 16. He's like, I'm going to build a border wall on Mexico. And people were like, oh, what a terrible human being. And whether or not you think that's true, the European countries now have a combined 10 border walls that measure more than six times the length of the Berlin Wall. because at some point in time, it was okay to say, you know what? We should have secure borders and we should decide and have a balance, skilled, unskilled refugees, skilled immigrants, unskilled immigrants, refugees, and decide who comes into the country. And if you've noticed this, it's now comfortable and okay to talk about international students and say, we want the best for the ones that come here. We want the best and brightest. We want people to come, go to our schools, be taught by our great professors and teachers, and then we'd love for them to stay and work and be part of the solution, not the problem. What's transpiring now, though, the story in the Globe and Mail yesterday, a spike in international student asylum claims. And right away, you would think, okay, this whole international student thing is being, you know, used properly by some. Of course that's true. Maybe even the majority. But it's clearly being abused by others as a way to get into Canada and, as importantly, stay here. Earl Blaney's a licensed immigration consultant down the road in London, Ontario, but really smart stuff on this topic. Earl, thanks for coming back on Toronto Today.
Thanks, Greg. Thanks for having me on. Good morning, Toronto.
When I lay out those student asylum claims, there's some at some community colleges that are just shocking. Niagara College, there were 20 of them in 2018. 5 years later, a half decade later, there's 530 and on down the line at almost every community college and some of the universities, we're seeing the same thing. Why is it just we've made this so easy?
Well, I think it's a few things. Certainly, it is easier for people who want to come into Canada to use the international study program than any other way. Those kind of applications are legitimized by all kinds of contextual documents, like a letter of acceptance from the school, financials, et cetera, that would suggest that you do have the intention of coming to study. So I think that's being used to facilitate entry for non-genuine students a lot. And that's not news. I mean, we've been well aware of that for a long time, as the volumes have drastically increased over the last few years, from 600,000 coming in 2019 to 1 million international students plus in Canada in 2023. So, you know, with that volume increase comes a lot of room to slip people through the cracks. And IRCC is having, Federal Department of Immigration is having a hard time assessing the mass volumes of applications credibly at this point. There's a lot more going on. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, one thing is, you know, who's coming in and why are they coming in? But the other thing is the students who are here, the over 1.5 million non-permanent residents who are the international students or graduates, most of them are coming in the first places, particularly at the community college level where these asylum claims are just exploding. Most of the students are coming to pursue permanent residency pathways. They've been promised that this is an easy go by the education agents overseas, sending them to Canada, making money off that in the process, commissions from the schools, et cetera, et cetera. But you've got mass quantities of people coming in under false promises, under false pretenses. When they get here, they're realizing now that, you know, the system is much more competitive, mainly due to volumes coming in. And they can't achieve permanent resident transition. So this is one of the many ways that they're using to extend stays permanently or try to gain permanent residency status.
And I think some of the tragedy of this is some of these students are clearly sold a bill of goods. There'll be work. There'll be a cheap place to live. But Earl, they may even be sold that you'll be able to handle the workload and the curriculum and it's easy. And you and I could look in the mirror or know people around us and we're like, oh, that person found university or college way harder than they thought they would. If they're to flunk out, let's say, after first year, is that where a lot of the asylum claims are coming from? They just don't want to go home. They're embarrassed. They spent the money together in the first place and they'll use any measure possible to stay.
Well, I mean, that's the essence of it. I don't suppose that in most cases it's a challenge with academics. Probably it's more of a challenge with financials. Mm-hmm. A lot of these students are coming to Canada, you know, and part of that process requires them to declare financials. Most of that money, in terms of what's being presented to the embassies when they're assessing these applications, are non-genuine funds. They're funds from money lenders. They're funds from aggregated recruitment platforms that lend students money to facilitate this process. I mean, it's not their money. There's no indication at embassy level when you're reviewing these applications that this person cannot afford or this person is not of the correct socioeconomic status to come. So, I mean, there are a lot of problems in how these applications are being presented to the embassies and the paperwork involved and who is behind the paperwork.
Earl Blaney's our guest, immigration consultant, education agent on Toronto Today. With a lower number, and we don't, some of these issues are baked in, I think, and especially in these university towns, we've talked about them before, like Kitchener, Guelph, London with Western and Fanshawe. Fanshawe's got a tremendously high number of international students, way more than Western does. With all these issues in the sort of smaller, B-level population towns, Do we look and think that we'll notice a difference this fall in a lack of international students and thus a lack of asylum claims, or way too early to tell?
Oh, I don't think it's too early to tell. The cap itself that has been imposed by the federal government is full of holes. The policy rollout on that has been just outrageous. The bottom line is, if you're looking for a major significant drop in non-permanent residents in Canada, which the government has framed this cap as facilitating, the cap is not going to do that. A one-in, one-out policy, which is how the cap is framed, for that to stabilize non-permanent residents volume in Canada, these students would actually have to leave, or the graduates have to leave at the end of their authorized stay. There is increasing evidence to suggest that that is not going to happen as expected.
Doesn't feel like there's something illegal about what it's believed that some immigration lawyers are doing. But of course, we could talk about the ethics of it. It's quoted. The quote in the story is a lot of immigration lawyers are telling them to file refugee claims to stay in the country. It's the last strategy to keep staying here. And as we said, that's one of those scenarios that that's from Richard Curlin, an immigration lawyer. There sort of isn't a real checks and balances for that. Doesn't sound like that's breaking the law, but it's up to somebody at some point to say, yeah, I'm not buying your asylum claim. You have to go back.
Well, there's a due process there. In Canada, just so everyone understands, cost to taxpayers on each of these claims ranges from $10,000 to about $35,000 plus cost of deportation. That's a failed claim. So that's build that into your, budget, Christmas budgets moving forward.
Yeah, yeah. Why have major universities not done what most community colleges have? Why the disparities is something. I was talking in the States over the weekend, and they're shocked by this. I'm like, nah, just Google this, because they have not had this happen at their schools. They have not had this happen at their universities or their tech colleges or anything, this explosion of the border, just for a post-secondary education. We have, they haven't.
The difference between community college and university international students is typically night and day. When you look at the data in the top 20 school of climate of asylum claims, 9 out of 20 are Ontario public colleges. Only 2 are universities. The reason for that is those institutions are attracting drastically different sorts of students to begin with. Students with lower socioeconomic status, students who are driven by edge immigration, are much more likely to attend community college, public community colleges in Ontario or elsewhere. The reason being the programs are cheaper and of shorter duration, i.e. cheaper. So universities, by the cost of their tuition, tend to attract more bona fide students. So that's the answer to your question.
Wonderful stuff. Really, really enjoy having you on, Earl. Thanks so much for the time.
Thanks very much.
Earl Blaney, immigration consultant and education agent. I got interesting thoughts on the other side on all that he laid out there. Many people, again, they're looking at us in Europe and they're looking at us in the U.S. going, what's going on? And this is all about providing the international student the opportunity. They've got responsibility. They've got accountability when they get here. You're supposed to go to class? Go to class. You're supposed to be here for education. If I go to Tokyo for school and all of a sudden I drop out, well, that aspect is on me. And I wouldn't expect, oh, I can just get a work visa. I've told this story before, but when working in the States, my visa was to work at one place. I had an H-1B visa. You work at one place. Hey, what if a radio station from Chicago wants to hire you? I mean, what if? Windy City? That sounds great. But my visa was only good to work in Detroit. I'd need to start utterly from scratch, foundation up, to get a brand new visa. We don't seem to have that kind of tightness here with immigration, period, and certainly with international students. We want to work for them. We want them to go back to where they came from, which sounds like a dangerous phrase anyway, and tell everybody what a terrible experience living in Canada was, or Southern Ontario or Toronto. that's not great for us in the long run or the short run. Hey, appreciate your time so much. Thanks for listening to Toronto Today podcast. And we're back live on the air 5:30 to 9. Hope to hear you then.